Welcome back to After the Buzzer. I'm Gordy Jones, and joining me as always from a social distance is that Mike Gross. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Gordy.
Hello, and joining us also as a special guest, Paul Hudrick, who covers the 76ers for 97.3 ESPN in South Jersey. Hello, Paul. How are you, sir?
I'm great, Gordy. How are you?
Good. So as we sit here, it's a Thursday night. The Sixers opened their two-game preseason on Tuesday with a 108-99 victory over Boston. Shake Milton, who has been the subject of much acclaim from new coach Doc Rivers, scored 19 points off the bench. Joel Embiid had 18. Tobias Harris reunited with Doc Rivers from their days with the Clippers, had 16. Paul, what jumped out at you about that game?
Defensively, I thought they were excellent. That's the one thing that, you know, we all thought they were going to be great defensively last year, and it didn't. They weren't poor last year defensively, but they weren't as good as we all kind of thought. This year, that should come to fruition.
Right.
You would think. I was really impressed with, you know, speaking of defense, Danny Green, and you know, he hasn't really gotten a chance to practice as much as maybe he would like because of the trade and all that. But I thought he showed what he can do, you know, getting in the passing lanes, how good he is on transition defense. And I think Seth Curry is actually a little underrated, at least defensively. You know, his size is certainly a factor, but I think, you know, he tries. Mm-hmm. And I think he's instinctive and he's, you know, he's smart. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, with the players around them, I think he's going to be a decent defender. So I think defensively, they really jumped out as a team that should be very, very good. And then offensively, you know, plenty of kinks they need to work out with the new offense, new coach, new parts and all that. But Shake Milton looked great. Tyrese Maxey, I thought, also looked very good. And, yeah, those are the biggest things that stood out to me.
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to be – I think they're going to be a little different in terms of half-court offense, Paul. More pick and rolls. We saw some of that stuff the other night, like the dribble handoff stuff that Embiid used to do with Redick. We saw some of that, but I think they're more pick and roll oriented. Do you think that's how it's going to be?
Oh yeah, and Doc Rivers has been pretty adamant all throughout training camp that that's the deal. They're going to run way more pick and roll, which I think benefits a lot of guys on this roster, mainly Tobias Harris, who, Gordy, as you mentioned, had so much success with Doc Rivers in LA. So for him to run more of those pick and rolls, I think that's something that he's very good at. And I think, you know, Doc Rivers put an emphasis on Tobias Harris wanting him to make quicker decisions and get downhill. And I think running the pick and roll, especially with a guy like Joel Embiid, gives him those opportunities to do that and, you know, and make quicker decisions and not, you know, and either, again, drive or pull up or pass. And I think that's going to, you know, simplify things. I think it's going to give his, you know, make him more confidence. But overall, I just love the movement. I thought there was way more movement than there ever was under Brett Brown. So that was one thing that stood out to me. I liked there was a couple instances where you saw Ben Simmons drive into the paint, and instead of Joel Embiid spotting up, which normally that's what he did, you know, two times he cut to the basket. One time he drew a foul, another time he got a layup. So I think little wrinkles like that are going to be huge. As you mentioned, you know, the dribble handoff stuff with Seth Curry, I think, is going to become a pretty big staple once everyone starts getting more comfortable with things. Danny Green is really good at just kind of finding, you know, he's a veteran shooter. He's good at just finding those spots. He's good at knowing where he needs to be so that, you know, whether it's for Joel Embiid out of the post, you know, out of a double team, whether it's Ben Simmons driving to the paint or whatever it is, you know, I think the movement's going to be better, and I think pick and roll is going to be a huge part of that. I think everyone's going to screen for everybody, and I think that mix is going to make is going to work out a lot better.
Mm-hmm. So, just overall, the team, the roster composition, the on the court mix just makes a lot more sense this year with Green and Curry in there as opposed to Josh Richardson and Al Horford last year, especially Horford, where it just, you know, he's had a great career, but it just didn't work with that group of players. So it just should make, from where you sit, I would imagine you would agree that it's just going to make a hell of a lot more sense.
Oh, yeah. And you could certainly argue, you know, as far as a more complete basketball, like, are Al Horford and Josh Richardson better overall basketball players than Danny Green and Seth Curry? Yeah, you could make that argument. But yet, from a pure fit standpoint, it's like not even close. Mm-hmm. Especially when you factor in, I think something that kind of gets overlooked a little bit with Seth Curry. You know, look, he's not going to be a guy who's going to break down people off the dribble, but he can handle the ball a little bit. He's mm-hmm. got point guard experience in his bag. He didn't do it a ton in Dallas last year because they had this guy named Luka Doncic who likes to handle the ball an awful lot and is very good at it. So, but, you know, with this offense, you know, he's much better suited offensively to play with Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid. And then likewise with Danny Green. So, you know, both guys over 40% from three-point range in their career. Mm-hmm. So that alone makes them a better fit. And then, again, even defensively, I think this all makes them a little better because Tobias Harris now kind of slots more in defensively as a four. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ben Simmons will take on likely the best perimeter defensive assignment. And then Danny Green will take on another pretty good perimeter assignment. But bumping Tobias Harris down to a four defensively, I think, helps their defense overall. So, yeah, from a fit standpoint, I think they've gotten substantially better. Again, you could argue talent-wise, all-around player, maybe not as much. But fit, it's unquestionable.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it's interesting because you sort of think of their starting lineup as three big athletic guys and two shooters. But Curry, I think Danny Green kind of is a 3-and-D type. But Curry can be that guy with the ball in the pick and roll. I think that's what you're saying, right? He's a little bit more that guy a little bit than maybe people think.
For sure. Again, when you put him in a pick and roll with a guy like, let's say, Ben Simmons, you know, what we saw Brett Brown kind of tinkering with last year with him and Shake Milton, there's no reason that Seth Curry can't do some similar things. And it's going to put defenses in a bind because you have to respect Seth Curry, you know, the highest active percentage three-point shooters in the entire NBA. Yeah. So you have to respect the shot when he's the ball handler in a pick and roll. And then, again, that dribble handoff stuff, some of those J.J. Redick actions with Joel Embiid, you know, J.J. is second to none as far as his movement off the ball, and he's so good at that. And, he's arguably the best shooter in the league when it comes to that kind of stuff. So maybe Seth isn't quite there, but there's no reason why him as, you know, Joel Embiid and Seth Curry can't establish a little bit of that as well. Yeah, and Danny Green, you know, to your point, Danny Green is definitely more of he's kind of the prototypical 3-and-D guy. I mean, right. That's what he does. I mean, which is, again, much needed. But, yeah, I do certainly think that Seth Curry, and Doc Rivers has hinted at this as well, that he views Seth Curry as a guy who can handle more ball-handling responsibilities. And I think I would suspect you see it a lot more, especially as, you know, as the guys get more comfortable and as they develop a little more chemistry.
To that end, you mentioned the Redick-Curry thing. There was a snippet of video that came out of preseason where he – you know, he ran that Redick action where he came out of the left corner and got the dribble handoff from Joel. And whereas JJ would either square up for a three or at worst have an elbow jumper or whatever, Seth kept on going and he kind of turned the corner. So they ended up having like a pick and roll on the fly where I think he lobbed to Joel. So that was, you know, that gets back to your point that Seth can handle it a little bit and can do at least that a little bit differently than JJ does. So I thought that was kind of an interesting new wrinkle to an old set that really kind of piqued my curiosity.
Yeah, definitely. And again, as much as JJ was, again, really phenomenal at off-ball movement and coming off screens and all that, he wasn't the greatest ball handler in the world. So with Seth, maybe you're not getting as much of the movement stuff, but you're getting a lot more to me ball handling. And yeah, that definitely adds a new wrinkle and it's a different thing you have to defend. So again, another situation where maybe it's not necessarily better, but it's different and it maybe gives defenses some other things to think about. So in that sense, maybe it is like a slightly better fit when you factor it all in.
Paul, do you have any insight into the whole Harden thing? Because it sounds like Harden would like to come here. How do the Sixers feel about Harden coming here? I know how I feel about Harden. I don't want to look at that shit for long. But what do you have on that? I don't know that anybody has anything definitive. But what's your take on that?
Sure. I mean, it seems to me that Daryl Morey wants to let this play out a little bit. He wants to see what it looks like with Doc Rivers, with, you know, Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid, and giving them that shooting that we talked about, and that, you know, and seeing that better fit roster and just seeing how it all comes together. It seemed, and you know what, if you're the Sixers, why hurry? You know, you don't have to be in a hurry to do this. It's so weird. And actually, Sam Amick just put out something from The Athletic today, and just kind of highlighted, you know, the top four teams that are, you know, supposedly in it in some extent or another, that Harden would like to go to. You know, the Nets, the Sixers, the Bucks, and the Heat. And it looks like the Bucks and the Heat don't really have much interest, which doesn't surprise me remotely. The Nets seems like they've cooled off. And then even then, I don't know what package the Nets are going to offer, you know, guys that maybe don't quite fit what they want. You know, they're not really, you know, Caris LeVert and Spencer Dinwiddie are good players, but do they fit with John Wall? And they're also not the youngest guys, and their contract situation. So I don't know if they're, you know, necessarily super attractive to the Rockets right now either. So, I mean, my take on it would be the Rockets aren't in a hurry, as they shouldn't be, and the Sixers aren't in a hurry to move on it, as they shouldn't be. So that's where I think it is. I think it's, of course, Daryl Morey is interested. I mean, for me, and for my personal take on it is, if you have the chance to get one of the greatest offensive players of all time, you poke around at the very least, and you see what it would take. I hear your concerns, because, listen, it's all very real. You know, what he's done, you know, the going to Vegas, going, you know, hanging out in Atlanta and all that, and then showing up late to camp. None of it's great. It doesn't look very good. He already kind of has that reputation, and, you know, some other pieces have come out that were scathing about the culture there and how they just kind of gave in to everything he wanted, and that wasn't so great. So now
I didn't realize the extent that is apparently the case until the last week or so, reading some of these pieces that you're talking about. Holy moly! I mean, he's really running the show.
Yeah, that's Tim McMahon from ESPN. He's been, you know, pretty on spot with all this, just kind of relaying everything he's heard, and it's crazy. And that's what there's a lot of talk about accountability here in Philly, but that's, you know, do you want to bring in Harden? Yeah, but you never know. Maybe if he's in a situation where he's here, maybe that changes things. Because, you know, he sees his window to maybe winning a championship dwindling, and you know, this would be a really good opportunity for him to be here. He would fit very well with the pieces that are here. So I don't know. I mean, for me, like, again, I think it's, for me, worth 100% exploring just because of how talented he is. But I don't think either side, the Sixers or the Rockets, are in any type of hurry to make something happen.
Speaking of accountability, there were reports about the Clippers' ragged season and how Paul George and Kawhi Leonard were kind of allowed to run the asylum. What is your take on that, and how that reflects on Doc Rivers?
It's such a bizarre situation in LA, because, listen, before that, Doc had built a really good culture, right? I mean, right. Especially the year before that, when he had Tobias, when he had Gallinari, when he had you know, Lou Will and Montrezl Harrell playing their best basketball. And you know, so before that, the culture was great. And then when Kawhi and Paul George came in, that seemed to be where things kind of took a turn. And I don't know how much, and I guess to an extent, like, how much of it was Doc, how much of it was from the front office saying, hey, keep these guys safe. Like, we don't know. We don't know, and no one knows 100% what the situation was there. But the fact that Doc isn't there anymore makes me wonder, you know what I mean? It certainly seems like ownership in the front office was siding with the players, and there was a disagreement. So that makes me wonder if maybe they didn't properly let Doc hold these guys accountable. That could be a bigger issue. So him coming here, and I think there is something too, like the fresh start for Doc Rivers, and then also for, like, Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons, right? I mean, if Doc comes here and gets to, you know, institute a new culture or a fresh start, Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons get a new coach and new teammates and kind of a new, you know, there's a new regime there. So they kind of get a fresh start, and it's like, okay, well, let's all kind of start just from scratch and see where it winds up. So I think it's maybe slightly concerning that's the environment that Doc Rivers is leaving, and then he's coming to an environment here that was supposedly, you know, had accountability issues. I do wonder too, there's some weird stuff too. I mean, not to get too much in the weeds with it, but with Paul George you know, previously dated Doc Rivers' daughter, and like, I you know what I mean? Like, there might have been a weirdness there. Like, I don't want to speculate, but that probably wasn't the greatest situation to have to deal with either. Right. So I just, you know, it's tough to know what to hold Doc Rivers, for lack of a better term, hold Doc Rivers for accountable in L.A. But I think what everyone's hoping for, at least here, is that everyone views this as a clean slate and lets everyone start over and let's build this culture afresh from the ground up.
What do you make of, speaking of Ben Simmons, I mean, the other night, just from an on-court standpoint, I thought it was kind of interesting how he was deployed, you know, as much as a low post guy in half court situations as he was a ball handler. And that was kind of interesting to me because, you know, there were times where we had Joel Embiid out high and Simmons in the low post, which is kind of a new wrinkle to me and kind of an interesting one that's probably worth exploiting going forward for sure. What was your take on that?
Yeah, I'm curious. I mean, Ben Simmons still isn't the great, you know, he should be a better post player because he's so big and he's so skilled and he's so athletic. But he wasn't really one of, like, a top-tier guy in that, you know, if you're looking at, like, advanced metrics and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. He's improved every year he's been in the league. But I hear what you're saying, and, yeah, I think any new wrinkle you can add just to kind of maybe throw teams off and throw something different at them, but to me, the better possession is Joel Embiid in the post at all times. If Joel Embiid is in the game,
agreed.
That's just my personal feeling on it. But I'm curious overall how he's going to get used because also in the first half, I didn't love his lack of aggressiveness, especially when he got to the paint. Times are clearly opportunities to go to the basket where he didn't. Mm-hmm. I want to give him the benefit of the doubt and say, new offense, new team, new coach. He's just trying to kind of feel things out. So maybe that's why. You know, a guy like Joel Embiid is aggressive naturally, so that's just the way he plays. So, of course, he took a ton of shots and made a ton of shots. That's just not Ben Simmons' way. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and say that maybe the lack of aggressiveness in the first half was just due to the new surroundings. In the second half, he was much more aggressive. And to your point, they put him in the post a bunch with Joel Embiid out of the game, mm-hmm. which I think is a better look when he's not in the game. If it's going to be, especially if there's going to be lineups where Ben Simmons is the five, and you're going to play four shooters around them, I love that idea because then you're just kind of picking the defense apart, guys cutting and things of that nature. I love that, for especially if you're going up against, you know, the Celtics the other night, for instance, put Grant Williams at the five.
Right.
If you're going to put Grant Williams at the five, you could put Ben Simmons at the five, and that would open up some interesting matchups and put, you know, put Brad Stevens in kind of some tough spots. So, yeah, I don't necessarily always love the idea of a Ben Simmons post up. I'd sooner see him play downhill and attack the rim that way.
Right.
But again, with him at the five, I kind of do like that idea of him maybe picking apart the defense and, as to borrow a Brett Brown term, quarterback in the
gym. There you go. Thank you. Everybody drink. Quarterback the gym. Yes.
We like you. We like anybody who incorporates Brett Brown terms.
He's got a ton
that's
of
plus. That's a plus for you, my man.
Well, just as an aside, Paul has a podcast called "Coming In for a Landing," which is that's more of a Mark Zumoffism, but. One of Brett Brown-isms was, what was it, landing the plane? Wasn't that how he was?
Landing the plane.
Yes.
With health spirit and something else. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But extra points if you can do his accent too, Paul.
Where is he now?
I think he's taking a break.
Yeah.
Seems like. Yeah. Because I'm sure he could have gotten a number of assistant jobs if he wanted them, right? And he also decided not to coach the Australian national team. Right. So I think he's just kind of. And listen, say what you want about Brett Brown. If there's anyone who's earned a break
after
7 years, I think he's the guy who kind of deserves it. So
yeah, that's a good point. That's a good.
I think he's a lovely man. I mean, I understand the criticisms of him as a coach, but I do think he's just. Generally, just a good egg, and I really wish him the best for sure, as I'm sure most people do.
Yeah, and listen, I think even he knew last year. He sounded like going into the playoffs to me at least. He kind of sounded like a defeated man. You know what I mean? Like he kind of sounded like a guy who didn't think his time was there. And I think he kind of knew he lost the team a little bit, and he did. And that's at least from the outside looking in, it appears like he lost the team a little bit, and. It's, and agree with you 100%, really good guy, you know, would always give good, thoughtful answers, wouldn't kind of, and if he couldn't, you know, he was straightforward, he was honest for the most part, so I appreciated that. And I just, sometimes it just runs its course.
Yeah.
And I think that's the bottom line. I think it just, it was time last year, and it was pretty obvious it was time, and he like I said, he seems like he was ready for a break now, because he's not coaching anywhere or anything, so I'm assuming he needed a break as much as they kind of needed to move on.
Yeah. And they always talk about how they always show the before and after pictures of presidents when they take office and when they leave office. And it was the same with Brett at the beginning of his term with Philly. I mean, longer time frame, obviously, but still. that job aged him for sure.
No, it definitely did. The hair looked a little thinner on top, and the skin looked a little more wrinkly than when he first arrived. So, yeah, I'm sure it took a toll dealing with all some of the stuff he dealt with over the years.
It had to. It really had to.
So, Paul, what do you think's the upside? What do you think I mean, I realize that's really asking a lot, but what do you think? What do you think's possible here?
It is really hard. I mean, right now where I see them, I mean, I think they're kind of like 4 or 5 in the East, if I'm being realistic, just because there are way more questions than answers right now, and that's my biggest reason for it. Especially, it's so hard to predict now because we're not going to get a good look in the preseason, and we're not going to, you know, if they get off to a fast start, I'll be really impressed just because of everything that's new and everything going on and not having much of a preseason, not having much of a training camp. I would be really surprised if they get off to a hot start. If they do, that's a really good sign for Doc Rivers and company that whatever they're doing is working. But listen, when you have two guys, when you have a Joel Embiid and a Ben Simmons, they're still so young in basketball terms, you know, 26 and 24 years old.
Yeah.
If they kind of realize their potential, that shoots them up. If they don't, that puts them down. So it's no matter what they do, yes, the roster is better fitting 100%, but if those guys don't take a big leap, then they're going to be stuck kind of, like I said, like the 4 or 5. If they take a big leap, then maybe they challenge, you know, for a higher seed. But right now, I still think Milwaukee is the team to beat in the East right now for me.
Yeah.
You have to put Brooklyn in that mix right now. When you add two dynamic players like those guys, like Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant, the Heat aren't going to go anywhere. They have Jimmy still, and they still have a pretty good young roster with a lot of shooting. Boston obviously not going anywhere, and even Indiana I think should be improved with a healthy Oladipo, and you saw kind of how T.J. Warren emerged in the bubble, a healthy Malcolm Brogdon.
Right,
the East got better, I would say, at least on paper, and coming into the season, it looks like the East got better. So that doesn't make the task for Doc Rivers any easier. So, again, like middle of the pack, I would say, in the East Conference playoff picture, with a chance to be better if those guys really ascend.
And the other part of the equation is, too, that Daryl Morey is one of those guys who's known for making the post-All-Star break move that kind of buffs up the roster a little bit. So that the team we see now won't be the one we see later in the year, I dare say, from a lot of different perspectives. From that perspective and also from, as you say, they're going to get better, I would think, as they go along and they get familiar with one another and familiar with Doc. But that's the other piece of it, too, that Daryl won't stand pat, I wouldn't think.
No, it's Daryl Morey. This guy is a tinkerer of all tinkerers. Like he's gonna look for things here and there. I mean, I was just wondering. I was kind of speculating out loud with Noah Levick, who does a great job at NBC Sports still.
Yes.
We were kind of just like talking about, you know, the roster, and you know, Justin Anderson got a little more guaranteed money to come here.
Right.
But someone on the active roster would have to either be cut or traded for him to make the roster because they have 15 guaranteed contracts.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious if perhaps in Daryl Morey and his infinite wisdom paid Justin Anderson a little extra money because Morey wants to trade either Ferguson or Poirier and open up that roster spot, but that would require that 19-day waiting period this year after a guy gets traded. So it would require Justin Anderson to maybe sit out and not be on a roster for the first couple games of the season, mm-hmm. while Darryl works some magic and opens up that last roster spot and then brings Justin back. It's totally just conjecture and me speculating and thinking, but I just think, just because Daryl Morey is so forward-thinking and kind of always calculated, I could see that. And just to your point about, you know, the trade deadline, they have a lot of tradable contracts. When you look at Ferguson's contract, when you look at Mike Scott's money, they have a lot of guys that they could combine, and they have a trade exception from the Apple deal, around $8 million. Mm-hmm. So they could make and not just an okay trade. Like, they could make a trade for a difference-making rotational player, mm-hmm. with the contracts they have, and if you want to package it with a pick, however you want to do it. I mean, there's guys out there that they could make it work. So, yeah, I mean, Daryl Morey is going to constantly kick the tires. He's never going to be settled until he has to be settled. Even with, like, the taxpayer MLE, they could use that maybe on, like, a buyout guy at some point. I mean, who knows? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think to your main point, this roster is not going to be the same exact roster after the March 25th trade deadline. Even beyond that, it's not going to look exactly like this, I wouldn't think.
I think this is the thing that's impressive about what he's done since he's been here, because we all thought of this as just the contracts on this roster. It was intractable. How are they going to change it much? And they've, especially on the stuff he did on around draft night. Now they do have. You're talking about some flexibility that they have, and some options that they have. Yeah, that's what he's done. That's been pretty smart. Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, to me, for my money, I thought he was the best. I mean, I get it, he hasn't won a championship, but to me, he's one of the best general managers in basketball, just as far as being able to think outside the box and also thinking forward, mm-hmm. You know, modernizing roster, the way he modernized that roster, just to at least kind of do something, because he knew what he was doing wasn't working. So he's like, all right, well, let me try something different, and let me try to cater to the new NBA and see what I can do, and, you know, just be super switchable. So, I mean, stuff like that, I mean, the Sixers needed it, right? They needed it desperately. They needed a guy who was forward-thinking. They needed a guy who's not afraid to take chances, but he's going to take calculated chances. And you know, he covets the superstars, so, like, he's not going to be, you know, cavalier in moving, you know, a guy like a Ben Simmons, because that's, like, the rumor that has come up, obviously, in the Harden thing. So, you know, he's not going to just, okay, here's Ben Simmons. Of course, he's going to do everything in his power to not give up Ben Simmons, because he worked so hard to get a guy like a James Harden and to get Dwight Howard when he was in Houston and to get Chris Paul and to get Russell Westbrook. He did so many things to get stars that he's not going to just hand one over. And like you said, the flexibility he's created, I mean, moving on from Horford's contract, too honestly, I mean, I felt like they were going to do it, but I only felt like they were going to do it because they had Morey. Like, if Morey's not here, is Elton Brand able to pull off a similar deal?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So that's right. It's so hard. And to get a player like Danny Green, who goes on an expiring deal and is actually a useful basketball player.
Yeah.
So that alone makes the deal worth it to me.
Mm-hmm. Yep. In that vein, how crazy does it drive you when you see Twitter trades, and how does it impact the way you do your job?
What's funny is that I am probably I'm tinkering and messing around with the trade machine, like, all the time. Mm-hmm. But the difference is I have the decency to just keep it in my own private channels and not display it for all of Twitter to see. It's a fun tool. It's fun to mess around with financial and, like, you know, see how finances work and
right.
See what's what, and, you know, and it does give you a really good idea. It keeps you as a writer. I love the trade machine stuff for myself, just because it keeps me educated and I know what's possible and what's not possible.
Right.
But yeah, when you have, like, random people throwing out ridiculous, like Al Horford for Buddy Hield straight up, it's like, yeah, that's not going to work. Like, I understand financially it works, but it's not work for the Sacramento Kings as a basketball team. So yeah, it drives me a little bit nuts, and I'll say that. You know, I'm appreciative at this current position that I'm with 97.3. I don't have to overreact to things. I can kind of, you know, write kind of when I want to write and write what I want to write about.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very good thing. It's a very good feeling to be able to do that. Yeah. So.
That's great to have that flexibility.
No doubt. All right.
So as we sit here, the Sixers close their two-game preseason tomorrow night at Indiana. They open the regular season next Wednesday by hosting the Washington Wizards with Joel Embiid's close personal friend Russell Westbrook now. So I'm assuming you were there on Tuesday, and I just wondered what sense you got of what it's going to be like covering the team in an empty arena.
So I actually was not there on Tuesday, but I will be there on opening night on next Tuesday. But yeah, I mean, it's going to be, because it's just going to be so different, because everything's going to be different. I mean, first of all, for me, I used to just, you know, I was in the NBC Sports Philadelphia studios. I just shoot right down.
Right.
And I was already in the building. So that was really easy. So now for me, it's going to be a totally different world, because I got to go into the regular media entrance and all that. Mm-hmm. And on top of it, it's just like the little things, like, you know, we would all gather in the media room and you know, maybe eat, you know, grab something to eat or whatever. That's not a thing. I think they're doing like box meals now for media that are there.
Right.
And you really can't congregate in small rooms that are closed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then even the seating, we're all normally behind the basket or in the press box. Now everyone's kind of spread out all along the floor. So it's going to be literally a different perspective that we're all watching the game from.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to make for an interesting thing. And then the empty arena is, aesthetically, I actually really liked what the Sixers did. I think it looked good.
It does.
It looked good.
Yeah.
And it sounded good. You know, the sound of the arena, it sounded good. And so I'm sure it'll be, again, a different experience when I'm actually there sitting in the seats.
Mm-hmm.
And I listen, there's nothing that replaces 20,000 fans
right.
flipping out and booing and all that. There's nothing that replaces that. But I am intrigued to hear little nuances.
Mm-hmm.
Hear guys communicate. Hear Doc Rivers yelling out at guys. I am interested in little stuff like that. If an altercation occurs between Joel Embiid and Russell Westbrook, I'm very interested to hear that conversation. So the little stuff like that you'll get that maybe you wouldn't have got before. So it's different. Some things are going to be kind of cool. Some things probably not as much, but. Again, you can't replicate that vibe that 20,000 people kind of bring to the arena.
Right. The sight lines will be a lot better. You'll be sitting along the sideline as opposed to the baseline, which
it's true. The basket will not block the other end of the court. That's true.
That'll be nice. So it will be a different experience. And as you say, you'll be able to hear a lot more, which the Sixers definitely don't like you to do that if they can possibly sure. avoid it. But there's no avoiding it.
It works better for basketball than football. I think this sort of empty stadium environment thing. I mean, I cover Penn State. It's unbelievably weird. But basketball, actually, as you described, I think there's some pieces of it that are kind of cool.
Yeah. Basketball is it's a very, like, I guess, I don't know how else to describe it, a very audible sport, because you hear the sneakers squeaking on the court. Even when there are fans, you hear the sneakers squeaking on the court. You hear the ball hitting the rim. You hear, you know, you hear kind of all those little things. You hear guys yelling N1 constantly. And stuff like that. So, yeah, and I imagine Penn State, I mean, that must be nuts with that, especially in that stadium. Geez, I mean, that's crazy.
And last week they had literally zero fans. Such an odd moment.
So to that point, I'm gonna sound really old, but years and years ago when we used to sit on the baseline in the Spectrum, you could hear all the players' interactions. And so the one time they're playing then the Bullets, and Dan Rounfield, this aged forward kind of at the end of the line, is lining up next to Barkley for a free throw. And so whoever's shooting takes the first shot. And Barkley looks at the referee, and I don't know what Rounfield did. He might have elbowed him. He might have done whatever. And Barkley just looks at the referee and goes, "He does that again? I'm going to fuck him up."
which probably happened constantly.
Yeah, and if you recall, he had kind of a love-hate relationship with Armon Gilliam, because the Sixers acquired Armon Gilliam for Jaminski, who was a friend of Barkley's. And so the ball goes out of bounds off whoever the Sixers are playing, and Barkley goes to inbound it, and he's muttering to himself, "Yeah, Armon, you can't dribble 2-3, motherfuckers."
Charles, man.
He was a classic. So at any rate, Paul, we will leave you on that note, and we appreciate the time as always and wish you well. Please stay well, and I hope our paths cross somewhere down the line.
Yeah, for sure, and I'm glad to do it, man. Anytime for you guys, I appreciate it.
All right, take care, be well.
All right, take care, guys.
Yep. Mike, what did you take away from our conversation with Paul?
Well, I thought what he talked about with the flexibility that they have in terms of their roster.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of was aware of that, but really wasn't aware of the details of that. And he was talking about parking a guy, sitting a couple games. I mean, if they have 15 guys under contract, you guarantee that they're going to make a move. I mean, there's no doubt about that. So something else is coming. I think they seem a little unathletic sometimes right now, and I think that could change.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever they do, we'll see. I mean, I'm pretty bullish on the Sixers. I think they have a chance to be pretty good. We'll see. And there's so many pieces. This is what makes the NBA interesting, how they fit together. We'll see. But I'm pretty excited about them.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting. As Paul mentioned, the top of the East is a little bit crowded, a little bit logjam with Milwaukee, Brooklyn, Boston, Miami, Toronto, and maybe Indiana if you want to slide them in there. So we'll see where the Sixers fit among that. But I think their two best acquisitions were Daryl Morey and Doc Rivers. They got the best available lead executive in the offseason, and they got the best available coach. So that's a pretty good starting point, I think, for any rebuild. Well, not really a rebuild, kind of a retooling, I guess, is a better way to put it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, and you know, when I look at the, like Miami, that might have been a little bit of a bubble thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not to take anything away from them. I'm not sure that was real.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I'm not 100% sure. Mm-hmm. They're definitely – Milwaukee's got to be the favorite. But other than that, I don't think there's anybody that I can't see the Sixers getting past if this works out.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm being overly optimistic. I don't know, but – the East is probably better, but I don't find it, you know, dauntingly better, I guess, would be the way I'd say it.
Yeah. I guess the counter argument about Miami is that they have some young guys who I think are really interesting. Bam Adebayo and Tyler Herro being at the top of that list.
I love Adebayo.
I do too. I think he's terrific.
He's really good, and they've got a great coach.
I
think he's one of the best coaches. And they have a team that's really built for the way the game is right now.
Yeah.
But I don't know. When a guy is as young as Hero, and he's a better player than he was in college at the NBA, I don't know. I hope that, you know, I like that kid, so I hope I'm wrong. We'll see. We'll see.
So we move on to other topics, and you mentioned this is kind of an interesting college football weekend. Clemson playing Notre Dame. It's a rematch of an earlier game that was won by Notre Dame in, what was it, triple overtime?
I think it was double overtime, yeah.
But Trevor Lawrence did not play for Clemson, so that would...
And a couple of defensive starts.
Correct, yeah.
I think that's almost as important. But anyway, I'm sorry.
No, but it, point taken, and I think that'll be an interesting game again, though. And... Penn State will have Illinois for their ninth game. Penn State riding a three-game winning streak and kind of got started a little late in every respect this fall. So we'll see how that proceeds from there. What are your thoughts about them at this point, Mike? It seems like they've figured some things out. And finally, I think you wrote it and Dave Jones, our friend Dave, also wrote it, just how they finally figured out who they are and where their strengths lie.
Yeah, well, you know, it's been funny because I think they always knew who they were, but it just didn't, in certain games, it just didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, generally speaking, their secondary has been very good.
Mm-hmm.
Again, their defense has been very good, those young D-backs, but they were horrible in the Maryland game.
Mm-hmm.
If they find a way to beat Maryland, okay, you lost that crazy game in Indiana. They lost to Ohio State because they're Ohio State. If you could beat Indiana, you're sort of back on track.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you could beat Maryland, I'm sorry.
Right.
Beat Maryland, you're sort of back on track. And they were so bad in that game. I think they were just were emotionally in the black hole in space
mm-hmm.
for a couple of weeks. And and lost to Maryland in a way that didn't really make sense. No disrespect to Maryland. And then lost to Nebraska, which is really a bad
team. Yeah.
Nebraska just isn't any good. They're probably the worst team in the Big Ten. So I think it took them, I think that just being 0-2, it was almost like a devastating emotional thing. And then the other piece of it is, I think they thought they could run the ball. Mm-hmm. They thought they could run the ball even when everybody knows they're going to run the ball. And there have been weeks this year when they did that, and there have been other weeks when their offensive line was horrible.
Mm-hmm.
So again, Nebraska, come on. They should have been able to move Nebraska off the line of scrimmage and move the ball. They were and run the ball. They were not able to do that. They've been so erratic in certain aspects of the game on a given week that it's not so much that they couldn't figure out who they wanted to be or what their identity was. It just didn't work. Lately, it's worked. I thought the way they played against Rutgers, and, you know, you could say, well, how far the mighty have fallen that we're talking about Rutgers. But that was the game where they really played the way they can be. Mm. Run the ball, play action, defense playing really fast and aggressive and downhill. That was who they could be.
So what do you think, how does this bode going forward? Is there anything is there a takeaway from this season that they can, you know, build on going into next year, assuming that next year is more of a normal schedule, which obviously we all hope that, you know, we are back to some sense of normalcy by the time, at least by the time they get ready for preseason practice and perhaps before, but you would hope that there is some sense of normalcy. Well, what do you think there is that they can possibly be built on going forward?
Well, I think they actually do have a lot coming back, and it is somewhat dependent on, this is this new normal in college football where, you know, the guys who are seniors, the current seniors can come back next year if they want to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many of them will, but they can, and they won't count against the 85 scholarships. The transfer portal is going to be a much bigger deal.
Mm-hmm.
Going forward, this is actually what I'm going to write about tonight for tomorrow's papers. How recruiting is changing, and the transfer portal is going to be a big thing. And Franklin, yesterday was National Signing Day, of course. So Franklin said, "Hey, we're not done. We're still recruiting, and we're still going to be involved in the transfer portal." And
mm-hmm.
and so it's almost like, There's free agency a little bit in this sport now, and that's going to change. But I think that's going to change the sport. I think they have enough coming back that it's possible to be about as bullish on them now as you were at the beginning of this year. Now, of course, it was not correct to be bullish on them as it turned out. But the other thing is they've had enough impressive freshman.
Mm-hmm.
Parker Washington, the wide receiver, has been really good.
Right.
Both of those, particularly Kevon Lee and the other, Keziah Holmes, two freshman running back, they were pretty good. They've had the redshirt freshman, but Joey Porter Jr. has really come on as a deep back, a corner. So I think their guys have performed. Their young guys have performed. Maybe overachieved a little bit, having gotten a chance to play that maybe they wouldn't have gotten if some things had played out a little differently in this crazy year.
The old blessing in disguise.
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting too. Did anybody jump out at you recruiting wise that they signed on signing day?
Well, a couple interesting guys. One is, I think the best recruit they got is a kid named Landon Tengwall, who is an offensive lineman from Maryland,
mm-hmm.
who was really highly recruited. Alabama finished second for him.
Mm.
And almost everybody offered him. He also considered Duke. Duke was one that he was pretty high on, and Auburn was in there too. It's kind of an odd group.
Yeah.
He's probably the best of their guys, and as you know, they lost out on our local guy Nolan Rucci, who was a 5-star mm-hmm. offensive lineman. But this kid is not quite at that level as a prospect. but he's kind of a high four star. Mm-hmm. And then they have another kid, and I'm drawing a blank on his name right now. He's from Malvern Prep. I think his last name is White. Mm-hmm. He's from Malvern Prep. He's a three-sport guy, and kind of baseball has been number one for him.
Wow.
So that's why he's not as huge. He's not as big a, in terms of the star rating, you know, in terms of that, the recruiting industry doesn't have him ranked as highly as maybe he has the potential to be. This guy's a freakish athlete. He really is. He's tremendous in hoops. Mm-hmm. He's an ongoing slam dunk contest in hoops. He played quarterback in high school. He's probably going to be a receiver, or, you know, he's one of those guys that they recruited, quote, as an athlete, unquote. And he is very intriguing. And then they also got the top-ranked kicker in the country.
Oh, okay.
But he's only a three-star because they don't. Nobody makes a kicker a four or five-star. You know what I mean? So there's some ways to look at their class in the class half-full way and say, maybe this class could be better, more useful than maybe the star rating or ranking them compared to the rest of the country mm-hmm. would indicate.
You're talking about Lonnie White is the
correct
prospect. He's listed as an athlete, 6'2", 210.
Yeah.
Originally committed to Clemson to play baseball.
Yeah, right.
How about that?
Yeah, he's a great outfielder. And was good in all three sports, and he's going to try to play baseball at Penn State.
Mm-hmm. That's
in addition to football.
And they had a receiver a couple years ago whose name escapes me who tried to do that, and I think he eventually ended up concentrating on baseball. My not Max, what was
yeah,
his last name?
Yeah, he did, and now he's out of the picture now. I can't believe I can't think of his name.
Yeah.
He was from Indiana, but he was. I don't think he had the upside overall as an athlete that this kid does.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This kid I hear big things about. He's potentially really almost a freakish mm-hmm. just in terms of raw physical talent kind of guy.
Okay. So we've reached kind of the last couple minutes here. This is actually going to be our last podcast of 2020, and good riddance to 2020, of course. But as next week, when we next Thursday, when we would normally tape is Christmas Eve, and the week after that was obviously be New Year's Eve. So Mike, I wanted to just plumb the depths of your memory and just what stood out to you about our guests and our podcast throughout this year. Anything that really jumps out at you?
Our guests have been consistently great. Mm-hmm. And surprising, you know, honestly, to be brutally honest, surprisingly so. I mean, sometimes you don't know what you're going to get for sure. And they've all been good. I kind of think I would pat us on the back a little bit for the way we adjusted during that period when there were no games. And that was what we did was kind of your idea, so I'll give you credit for it.
Thank you.
Which was to kind of look back on things from the past that we had both covered or that one of us had covered and the other had watched and with interest. And I thought that was good. I thought that worked out well. And that was kind of, as I look back on this year, particular, that's kind of the thing that sticks out to me. Obviously, we've got to do a better job of finding an audience for this thing and working around the margins to kind of to make it better. And that's certainly something that I would like to do. But it's fun, and the guests have been great.
Yeah.
And when the guests weren't an option, I thought we did okay. I guess that's what I would.
Yeah,
I would summarize.
I do like what you said there. I think those are all great points. There were two things that come immediately to mind. And the first one was when Joey Crawford, the retired NBA referee, told us about his last game, how he broke down physically and couldn't continue in the last game of his long career. And Richard Jefferson, the player, sought him out in the official's locker room just to wish him well. And I thought that was really moving to me, the way he described that scene.
Cool. Yeah, that was great.
That was really neat.
And Richard Jefferson has gone on to become a pretty good broadcaster.
Yeah. Yeah, which is not surprising. He's a really bright guy, and obviously he has a real compassion too, that he would actually seek Joey out, because I don't think a lot of players would do that. I mean, it's just like,
yeah,
you know,
I don't think I would, and not because I have any sort of belligerence or, but that, right. That would never occur to me. You're right. Yeah. That is kind of special. And he was good. He was a great guest.
Yeah, really. He's such a good Philly guy.
Yeah, he's got it written all over him. He sounds like it. He looks like it. That's who he is.
Yeah.
No doubt.
And the other thing that stood out to me was our guest last week, Les Bowen, well, now Philly.com. I keep on wanting to say Philadelphia Daily News, since that's where he really was embedded for so very long. And when we talked to him just about what keeps him coming back, and he mentioned just about how he just wants to get it right, and he enjoys the words, and he just wants to finally hone his craft, and he doesn't feel like he's there yet, but it's always out there. And, you know, maybe when he's 90, that'll finally kick in for him. So I thought that was an interesting commentary, because I think that's a sentiment a lot of us in this profession share, that it's just like,
yeah, and especially when you're getting to our age, and we've sort of walked this path for a long time now, to still want to do that, because we're all, you know, we're kind of close to the same age as Les. I think he's a little older than we
just are. a couple years.
and also Les has been on twice, and what a thoughtful guy and what a smart guy, and
yeah,
just a great and just has a real genuinely manner about him. He's, for a sports writer, you know, we're normally sort of caustic and edgy, I guess, in our way of communicating, and he's nothing like that, but still really a fun guest, I thought.
Yeah, he just is. He's a Southern gentleman. So, and anyway, I think that's where we will leave you for this week and for this year. And thank goodness we're coming to the end of this year, because next year can't be any worse, I wouldn't think. I hope not.
Yeah. You know, we were talking to Franklin the other day, and we were talking about this. Somebody asked me about the snow that's coming, and he just went, 2020, baby, 2020. We're all going to be saying that going for years to come, I think.
I think maybe.
2020. Yeah. What more do you have to say? 2020.
Yes. So on that night, we will bid you fond adieu and see you again next year. Best all you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year indeed.